impulses are being redirected. We are living in an artificially induced state of consciousness that resembles sleep.
Long. Did you hear that long, folks? I mean, this kind of, that kind of long.
Bell, come on.
Welcome to another live edition of Precognitive
Dissonance. We're Craig York
and Smiles Lewis. For real this time.
Yeah. Where's our theme music?
Oh, you're just not hearing it because.
Oh. Okay.
Oh, hey, yeah, those headphones aren't even plugged in.
Oh, well, that would explain much.
After those nice things you said about them, too.
Let's just open with a quote that seems especially germane. I happen to pick up this copy of the Coffee News, locally published advertisement and hoo-ha sheet. It's got trivia at the bottom. But there's a section, quotable quotes. As we acquire more knowledge, things do not become more comprehensible, but more mysterious. Albert Schweitzer.
Schweitzer.
Yeah, I thought that was especially germane, because, you know, I'm more and more baffled every single day. But at the same time...
But is it by strange, anomalous things, or just everyday life things?
I consider strange, anomalous things part of everyday life, so yes.
Well, see, there we go. See, anomalies aren't even paranormal. Paranormal things aren't even anomalies, are they? They're just normal.
Everything is.
It all works out in the bell curve.
Well, I was going to say just a quick, not exactly a non sequitur, but, you know, I saw something coming home from the bus yesterday afternoon that just... I had been feeling kind of melancholy because I celebrated my 49th birthday a couple of days ago. Thank you.
Yeah, you made it.
So far, almost a half century of progress towards some mysterious and ill-defined goal. But anyway, like I said, I was just kind of feeling life, blah. Coming towards us was this semi with this odd-looking object on it, and as we drew abreast of it, I realized it was the blade of a wind turbine.
Like a big wind farm type of...
Yeah, and you know, it's one of those things, I've heard about these things for years, I've seen pictures of them, but until you see the components of these things... in the real, as it were, you don't really get a sense of the scale of the things. I mean, as you and our listeners know, I build model airplanes and that sort of thing, so I know what a propeller looks like. And when the modern wind turbine is usually a three-bladed configuration, very much like an old-fashioned airplane propeller. But these things were like 60 feet long. You know, 6 feet across at the base. And here they came, one right after another, you know, three of them.
Three semi-trucks.
You know, on their way to some installation somewhere. And all at once, you know, I got that kind of popular science in the 50s. It felt like the future. You know, yeah, it's not flying cars and personal robots yet. But, you know, it was just one of those, well, it is happening. And kind of akin to the feeling that I got when the Berlin Wall came down. Because, you know, even in the early 80s, who suspected that Soviet communism was going to go belly up in such a spectacular fashion?
Yeah, not me. I was scared witless.
Yeah. Well, you know, we both grew up with the Cold War. We both grew up with the specter of atomic annihilation.
Yeah, my mom's told me the her growing up horror stories of how paranoid about it she was, and it definitely it wasn't. I wouldn't say that she instilled that fear in me, but I mean certainly did add to it.
Yeah.
And I didn't expect it, and it was quite a strange relief.
And it's, you know, it's one of those, it's kind of like the old story about the monkey in the well, two steps up, you know, climbs up two stones, slides back one, you know, but there, you can look around and see sometimes, there is a little progress towards the world's good. And, you know, like I said, it just felt like the future.
I'd like to say I'd really it'd be make me feel even better if I just if I saw, you know, more frequent signs of the use and implementation of that sort of alternative energy, rather the first energy or one of the first.
Well,
I mean,
you know,
obviously not in the formation of planets and whatnot, but I mean, you know, once a planet's formed, hey, there's one form of energy you've got available to you if there's any motion at all on the planet.
Well, and, you know, it made for a fair balance because we had watched Blood Diamond earlier in the week, which is an extremely graphic and, you know, ultimately hopeful if you don't think too deeply about the fact that, yeah, the African guy gets his family back and, you know, does sell the diamond, you know. But, you know. Anyway.
On to some weird news, man.
Yeah.
There were some things that you wanted to talk about at Cryptomundo, but I know that's going to go into a pretty long-winded conversation, possibly. So
I'm thinking, you know, let's save that for the meat.
Some of the headlines that caught my attention via places like Anomalist.
Another goat man.
From the Bowie Blade News, that's BowieBlade.com. Legend of the Goatman still lives on in Bowie and around the world, says Jane McHugh, staff writer.
I'm guessing this is Bowie, Maryland. Maryland Gazette. And
in the spirit of Halloween, it looks like that they're, you know, oh, hey, trot out the good old-fashioned spooky local haunt monster story. With Halloween around the corner, it's time to revisit the legends of this half-man, half-goat hybrid who's long been rumored to creep around the woods of old Bowie. But first, it should be noted that in recent years, Bowie's very own Goatman has gained worldwide fame. He's been featured in a British documentary on strange creatures, Animal X, that's been televised on Animal Planet, in which the King's English-speaking narrator refers to him as Goatman.
I have seen, like, one or two episodes of Animal X, and it's in very much the same vein as another British Travel Channel paranormal show, Most Haunted, Most Haunted is an interesting contrast with our own American Ghost Hunters, which follows a crew of blue-collar ghost hunters based in Rhode Island, who go about, you know, waving EM counters and recording
infrared
EVPs
cameras.
And spectral phenomena, and, you know, taking what they assert is a very scientific approach, which, you know, we talked about in the past, whereas Most Haunted is very much more old school. They go in with a psychic, a medium, who, you know, inevitably encounters some sort of spiritual energy. I don't think I've ever seen them use a Ouija board.
Not yet.
Kind of
season
interesting
four.
Too.
Actually, I don't know what season they're on. I haven't seen
any
of that in a long time.
And we were talking about Goatman last week with Nick on the show.
I think it came up.
And he was talking about the Goatman of Lake Worth.
It's just the tire chucking hippie of Lake Worth.
This and well, it it's interesting because here we've got a goat man who sounds like another Lover's Lane kind of spectral beast. Here's one witness saying, Hayden told him, the author of the book, that he and a relative saw a strange creature near Zug Road in 1971.
Woo-hoo.
It was an animal. It was about 6 foot, something like that, and hairy like an animal. As far as I know, it was an animal on 2 feet. I remember it made a high-pitched sound like a squeal.
Now, I went yee-hee because, yay, 1971. My birth year. It's my birth year.
And the following day, they find a decapitated dog.
Ooh. And Zug Road, I couldn't help but think.
Zug Zug.
From the silly comedy Caveman with Ringo Starr, Zug Zug is to have sex.
Oh, and you know, I've never actually seen Caveman.
Oh,
I've seen stills from it, and I've heard it's a hoot.
I loved it. Of course, I was a real young kid at the time. But anyway, so yeah, Lover's Lane, Zug Road.
Uh huh.
Yeah, I know it's a stretch, but it's almost the name game. Maybe, I don't know. I have to ask Lauren about that one.
Well, if Zug Zug is copulation, then Zug would be.
Takes two to tango. Okay.
Yeah. I'm sorry I brought it up. This thing was for real. This was not folklore. I don't know what it was. Whatever it was, I believe it killed my dog, and was living in the woods around there for some time.
Yeah. So you can read more about this over at BowieBlade.com. Legend of the Goatman still lives on in Bowie and around the world. BowieBlade.com.
Article by Jane McHugh. Whoa!
Yeah, and jumping. This is a really great one. Police say pantless man claims leprechaun opens door. So it's okay. Cincinnati. A man was caught Tuesday morning inside a car with his pants down. Police said Kim LeBlanc broke into a parked car overnight on Central Parkway. An owner found him asleep inside and called police. Officers said LeBlanc was not wearing any pants when they arrived. Investigators said LeBlanc told them he had done drugs and believed that a leprechaun had let him into the car. LeBlanc remains in police custody on a variety of charges. And the picture of him is rather hilarious. He looks really stoned and scruffy and, you know, not unlike many of my friends and hangers-on in Austin.
I'm reminded of nothing so much as some ancient Chinese sage who's just been asked, so, Master, what must I do to attain enlightenment?
What? Don't go on top of? Yeah, so this is over at WLWT.com. And I don't know, this is another stretch, I'm sure, but LeBlanc, leprechaun, I don't know.
Means L-E-B. The white in French, and he is very definitely the white guy.
It's just a look.
I'm not sure what leprechaun translates into.
Well, you can't have my pot of gold. Okay, that was really bad.
Oh, it's after me, Lucky Charms. And you know, that's I didn't mention it earlier today, but I was kind of hoping we'd get a chance to touch on just Portian films in general. And you know, there's something that's a mystery to me. The Leprechaun series of films. Have you ever actually seen any of those?
Hell no.
I know.
They've got a huge cult following, I guess because they're just so stupid.
Well, yeah. You know,
are there
I've
many
seen one, and it was kind of...
Who are fans of Leprechaun?
What the hell? You know, it's interesting in the sense in that it does portray a leprechaun as a fearsome creature, you know, as some, you know, an elemental force not to be trifled with. You know, unless, of course, you're the final girl in the script, in which case you figure out how to outsmart the leprechaun. You know.
Like getting him to say his name backwards? Wait, that's...
What?
Rumpelstiltskin?
Something like that.
Is it?
Yeah, Rumpelstiltskin was... Well, I'm not sure if Rumpelstiltskin was a leprechaun or a gnome. I think.
I just meant how you got rid of him, like tricking it, like in the animated
superhero series where you get a... No, that's Mixoflick. Never mind.
Yeah. A leprechaun-like character. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
My associativeness is spinning out of control.
While remaining perfectly still. Something about Hypno.
Oh, this is, I love this. I mean, it's freaky, and it's, again, like this, the previous article, very short. Hypnotist show in Logan sends girl to the hospital by Ben Winslow, Deseret, Morning News. Logan, a comedy hypnotist show, didn't leave many people laughing when a 17-year-old girl had to be hypnotized, hospitalized. Logan Police said the show was put on last week at Logan High School for homecoming. Logan Police Captain Eric Collins said he was attending a girls' volleyball game next to the auditorium and came out of the gymnasium to see the 17-year-old girl being wheeled into an ambulance. Quote, she was hyperventilating and very panicky, Collins said Monday. I went inside to see what was going on, and it was kind of chaotic. The hypnotist was in the audience, going around to different people in the audience, attempting to get them out of a state of hypnosis. Police said several young women had problems and were not able to snap out of their hypnosis easily. The show ended up being canceled by school officials, officers said.
And that's the substance of the story.
That's it. I mean, so...
Holy mackerel.
What's
92,
the name?
92 comments, though. That's interesting.
Well, and what's the name of the hypnotist? So... Anyway, yeah, 92 comments looks like a bunch. But I'm really, that's interesting. I mean, I've often wondered, gosh, you know, it seems like something bad's bound to happen eventually with so many stage magicians and hypnotists doing all kinds of willy-nilly things and really nobody knowing for sure what the heck hypnosis is. It just seems like it was a matter of time before something bad happened. Now, this... thankfully doesn't seem to be that significant. I mean, I can imagine just about, you know, 1 out of 10 people maybe, probably 1 out of 100 maybe, having a severe a panic attack like response to hypnosis or maybe being put under and then suddenly snapping to but thinking that they're still under. Who knows? I mean,
this is weird to me because it's the first time I've ever heard of this kind of phenomena occurring in a hypnotist show. Are you you're familiar with other instances?
No,
like this,
I'm not. But I mean, I've certainly seen news reports and TV vignettes and just time after time after time people doing, you know, these crazy things on stage and often humiliating and often the kind of thing that you're just like, why would these people let themselves do this? Most anthropologists and psychologists attempt at rationalizing how it's possible or simply just saying, well, humans are highly suggestible and there's, you know, it does go back to those stats that Huxley quoted about, you know, 20% of the population are highly suggestible and 20%.
Aldous Huxley?
Yeah. Oh. Now, this wasn't from his studies. These were studies that he was quoting from. And 20%, another 20% of the population are highly not suggestible. And the part in between, 50-50. And I'm sure that there's better stats out there than that on, and I'm sure the advertising and marketing monstrosities have all the data.
The only time I've ever seen hypnotism in the flesh, as opposed to on some Travel Channel show, is when I was going to Europe. In 1974, the leader of our tour was a professional hypnotist, a fellow named Jack Lithgow, and he performed for us. We were taking the ferry from Athens to Brindisi, Italy, across the Aegean, and he put on a show for us that evening in the... lounge of the ferry, and yeah, it was, you know, just fairly standard hypnotism fare, you know, quack like a duck, you know, walk back to your seat with one shoe off, you know, and when I snap my fingers, you'll come out of it, and you know, it's very strange.
And you didn't participate, you just
that
you know of.
Well, I've always wondered if I am hypnotizable. I've never, and frankly, I rather not find out.
Yeah, I've been curious about it myself. My general opinion, and I'm always quick to give it out for free, is that hypnosis is really just so little understood. I wouldn't. It's people who are dealing with strange memories that might actually be of dark or spooky things might really, really, really think twice about undergoing hypnosis. I know that, you know, people's desire to explore, you know, gaps in their memory is certainly one that's a worthy cause, but everything I know about parapsychology indicates that hypnosis is like several other altered states of consciousness, even though it may actually not technically be like, you know, radically different from just like the alpha state, a brainwave pattern that's not, you know, significant. It's not like deep trance necessarily, though. Again, actually, I think that quote I was saying about Aldous Huxley's stats were like 20% of the population is not just highly suggestible, but is it can access, I think, deep levels of trance hypnosis, but I could be misremembering that as well.
I freely admit it's not a subject I know anything about. It's awfully interesting.
We found another
this is yeah, this is another story, but once again, the hypnotist is not named. This story is a little bit more extensive. And something I found interesting in there. In a statement from the Logan City School District, the hypnotist followed the same script that he has for years, without experiencing prior incidents. On this particular evening, two students had a negative reaction. So, you know, obviously this is a guy who's been performing this act for years.
Which is probably why they're not just rushing to smear him by putting his name in there.
Yeah.
I guess. It seems like a lot of restraint for mainstream news. But so
unusual in both instances.
This is from abc4.com, Hypnotist Act Sends Logan Girl to Hospital. And this one's by Annie Cutler. hypnosis is fascinating to me. I've heard so many incredibly wild claims that I think often have been backed up by some experimentation. I mean, I've heard things... Well, first of all, it's apparently absolutely true that people with allergies... severe skin reactions, you know, to certain allergens can be put into a hypnotic state, exposed to the allergen, but told it's something that they're not allergic to and not have a reaction, and vice versa, where they're touched with something that's totally innocuous, that they have no known allergy to, told it's an allergen, and then they react. This is why hypnosis has been used in surgery, has been used in dental operations, and for everything from trying to quit smoking to losing weight to just, you know, attempts to relieve anxiety. It is a powerful tool, and I think it so deserves so much more areas of research. But some of the wildest things I've ever heard, I forget the source for this, but I've read that there was an experiment where they basically had a person sitting in a chair and put stuff behind the person, and they hypnotized somebody that was in front of the person in the chair and basically, you know, told that there was an empty chair in front of them and that behind it was an object and that they were able to describe the object. Now, if that's not freaky, I don't know what is. It's very much like, sounds like remote viewing or clairvoyance
that's,
or something.
Yeah.
Another thing that I know where the source is, and that's a famous... consciousness researcher Charles Tart, whom I respect immensely, he did experiments in mutual hypnosis. And this is another area that's just fascinating and sounds so outrageous and amazing. But they did experiments where they had two trained hypnotists hypnotize each other. And he basically would you know, query them as they were going through the experience. And what seemed to happen over and over again was that they started co-experiencing a reality that was completely independent of the directions of the outside world, and that it was consistent between them without them establishing verbally what those consistencies were. Now, obviously, this would be a very difficult thing to test experimentally, and I don't know, I mean...
I believe these weren't conducted like with two people hypnotized and then put in separate rooms, which would probably make it a lot more believable to the hardcore skeptic. But it was really interesting, and I think I read that in a Whole Earth review years ago.
To me, the idea sounds almost completely counterintuitive. One of the things, obviously, that I think puts me off hypnotism, or that I admit makes me uncomfortable about it, is that you're placing yourself in a position of almost complete vulnerability.
Yeah.
By submitting to hypnosis,
and I think that's key to understanding it. It is, I think, part of human neurophysics that we have. I think most species have ways that their various functions are shut off, not in ways that make them die from stopping breathing, but that make them kind of go into a stasis. And, people talk about, cats being grabbed by the scruff of the neck and they just kind of go limp. Not all cats, but typically that's the most common.
It's a breed
called
the ragdoll that's supposed to be very famous for that.
And then apparently this thing with chickens where you can put their heads under their wing and they just get really calm.
Stroking the bottoms of lobsters.
All right. But what I think I
think it's lobsters, and I can't remember if it's the top or the bottom.
I'm not sure if I finished my thought earlier about the thing with hypnosis and parapsychology, and that's simply to say that, again, the thing we know about anomalous cognition is it tends to occur in altered states of consciousness that are not beta state consciousness, your everyday analytical brainwave activity. And so anything, even something as simple as meditation or breathing exercises or going under hypnosis, and dare I say,
of course you dare.
I dare. Sitting in the barber's chair. I don't know. I always found that incredibly relaxing, but maybe that's not the same altered state of consciousness.
Yeah, and I quite agree. I think one of the most delightful experiences any man can have is a good barber shave.
Well, it gets back to that putting your life in somebody else's hands kind of thing.
Well, I tend the tale of Sweeney Todd. Avoid barbershops with pie shops next door. That's our advice for the week. But I haven't had one in ages, but I remember back when I was in my late teens, early 20s, there's a couple of occasions where I went and had a barbershop shave, and it's an incredible experience to have that hot towel just completely wrapped around your face, lean back in the chair, chairs.
And offer your neck like a sacrificial lamb.
That's one of those instances where that thought never crossed my mind. Of course, I was unfamiliar with the legend of Sweeney Todd at the time. But, and in fact, the only time I was ever in real danger was by a man holding my boombox in one hand and an open straight razor in the other. So,
So you're no stranger to being threatened by the implements of the barber.
Oh, and
isn't that pretty?
It's gorgeous. I mean, it's almost biomechanical. It's what we're looking at, folks, is a, I would guess, a jellyfish. The headline is Scientists Discover Rare Marine Species, and the photograph enlarged comes up as Celebes Sea Species. Is this related to something that we covered a week or two back about that mysterious zone?
I had completely forgotten about that.
Manila in the Philippines.
Scientists exploring a deep ocean basin.
Isolated for millions. Yes.
Yeah.
Including a tentacled orange worm and an unusual black jellyfish.
Which is not this one, I guess.
No.
This one's kind of very much red with yellow tentacles and a dome that looks like... I mean, to me, it looks like a really cool, like a cross between a classic flying saucer and like James Trevor Constable's Space Critters.
this is the embryonic form. I couldn't help but notice that's the first of several pictures. So if you want to enlarge that again.
Where'd it go?
And let's see what... Let's frustrate our listening audience.
A yellow puckerfish.
Well,
look at those. It's got hexagons.
Yeah. It's a game fish.
It's a game. Roll that. And actually, it's angular like a four-sided die or something.
This is one of the more box-shaped.
It's got a mouth and an O shape. Like it's a
juvenile boxfish. I knew there was a different term for them. They're actually very slab-sided. Their bodies have angles and corners because of the nature of the kind of semi-armor-plated condition of their skin. And they are, I think, related to pufferfish. They do inflate.
Oh, wow. It's really cool picture. And some guy reaching out and touching some other jellyfish with a long black striped tail of some sort. Dr. Larry Madden of the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution shows a slide of a research diver collecting a specimen during a recent research voyage in the waters of the Celebes Sea.
This is Yahoo News, by the way, folks.
Ooh.
Gorgeous jellyfish.
Yeah, one of these really clear, translucent ones, but with these strange yellow tentacles at the center that seem to go back up into itself, almost as if it's like a flying enchilada. Same thing, pufferfish. Looks like brine and shrimpy
petri
things.
Dish full of shrimp.
Fuzzy ones, too. More...
very pretty deep ocean squid with strange red eyes.
Big black bulbous, that'd be something.
It's a squid.
and it's rather translucent as well, with you able to see some kind of pinkish organ inside of its upper body.
Well, you see pinkish organs everywhere, Miles.
I try not to.
He was, and that photograph, incidentally, was a juvenile... half a centimeter, which is like 5 millimeters, which is less than a quarter of an inch long.
Whereas the picture is probably 4 inches, 5 inches tall. And another picture of another translucent but more flattened pie shape jellyfish with really, really long tendrils. And we're back to the red... it also looks like one of the space critter things from one of my favorite science fiction B-movies, Star Crash.
Oh!
There's several things that look like that.
I really need to see.
Oh, God, I recommend everybody see that. It's
not just because of Carolyn Monroe. Yum, yum.
Carolyn Monroe. Yeah, duh. There's two things in that movie that look rather like that. This red jellyfish with the clear dome on top, and these yellow tentacles. Except there's a green tentacled creature that's like a judge in a galactic prison, and several other things. And I just wanted to comment on American Chronicle is continuing to do their rather interestingly slanted.
InfoWar, yes. I saw this. I saw the headline in the Anomalist. I didn't actually look at it.
I haven't gotten that deep, but I read far enough to read the bit where he describes Colonel John Alexander as being the Darth Vader of the national security state.
One of the main tenets of war is to learn from the adversary, so I consider John a teacher from the dark side. Me, John, is a microcosm of the... national insecurity state, and to understand how he thinks is how to understand the national insecurity state itself. In comparison to Darth Vader.
And I know a lot of paranormal and UFO researchers have characterized John in very negative ways, and I certainly, he's creeped me out plenty over the years. Just, there's something about his demeanor and look and what he does. He's a thanatologist. He's a death scientist. He's been really involved in a lot of the advanced
research and development of non-lethal or less than lethal technologies, electromagnetics and whatnot. Interestingly enough, he is considered by some to be a member of the Aviary. And for those who don't know what the Aviary is, that's this supposed group of insiders who some believe are trying to leverage the truth from the government about the nature of UFOs. Others maintain that no, they're actually part of a group that's working for the government to disinform the public or to, at the very least, prepare the public for whatever the government wants us to believe about UFOs. And he's considered to be the Penguin amongst the Aviary. I've only...
I hope that means he professes a fondness for fish and is an excellent swimmer. Not that he goes around in a tuxedo making noises like Burgess Meredith.
No, and I've heard... a number of friends of mine have met him over the years or been, you know, around him briefly and said that he seemed like a warm and friendly fellow, and he's really good friends with Hal Puthoff, the famous researcher who's now doing zero-point energy research here in Austin and who is famous for his research and patents in laser technology and working on the Stanford Research Institute's remote viewing program, which turned out to be funded by the Department of Defense, CIA, and all sundry military-industrial complex, but who, again, seems to be like a really great guy. All my interactions with Hal have been so wonderful and nice and informative and educational. It's hard for me to imagine him being part of some nefarious conspiracy. He just always seems so open and honest, aside from having to not say certain things because, well, they haven't been declassified yet. So, anyway, this article goes on saying, quoting John, is saying, "In preparing for conflict, perception management is essential. The adversary should be led to believe that he is vulnerable and will lose if war is initiated. To deceive the enemy is a fundamental tenet of war. However, it was not until 1994 that Doctrine on Deception was published, and that was in response to the burgeoning field of command and control warfare. The target of the deception is the enemy's decision-making process. This may be done by directly influencing the leaders or by manipulating the beliefs of the people who must support them." Or, I would say, smiles Lewis here, that you can influence them with certain types of electromagnetic technology, sonic technology, vibratory technology, and the sundry other mind control technologies.
I don't know. Knowing my World War II history, I'd have to say that's a bit because, you know, deception in warfare, manipulating the enemy's perceptions, that was a big part.
Was it Lao Tzu?
Not Lao Tzu, but Sun Tzu.
Sun Tzu.
Classic art of warfare, you know, goes into it very deeply, but,
Machiavelli and just World War II, yes, the rise of the really sophisticated disinfo networks. I mean, the book Bodyguard of Lies is an excellent source on all the deceit, deception, and double cross that went on in World War II that was coordinated by the London Controlling Section under the streets of London, coordinating the Allies' disinfo campaigns against the Axis.
The author of the article goes on to say, "This is such an important statement because when America's national security apparatus in World War II and through the Cold War used the same unethical means to destroy the adversary that the adversary was using, it moved the evil without into the evil within. As that happened, the national security state became the national insecurity state and inadvertently began attacking its own public. One is reminded of Creon in the Greek tragedies, who destroyed his own family for the state, only to realize as an old man that his family was the state."
Wow, that's cool. I mean, I'm going to have to read deeper into this.
That's one of the Greek tragedies that I don't know.
Yeah,
I'm not familiar with that one. And it's certainly an interesting interpretation.
And this is over at AmericanChronicle.com by, what's this guy's name? Oh, yes, Ed Komarek, K-O-M-A-R-E-K. So, we've got stuff over at the CryptoMundo.com site.
Yes, indeed. This is, actually, it's me feeling especially precognitive again, because you recall a couple of weeks ago I was not exactly bemoaning, but kind of just speculating what cryptozoology would be like if Bernard Hovelmans had not coined the term. And sure enough, over the past week and a half, I think I've commented on Darren Nash's series, finally, initially on the crypto conference that he attended, he and Nick Redfern both attended a couple of months ago, and in more depth and more generality, in a couple of more recent blog postings, he basically said, essentially, well, you know, there are unfortunate aspects to cryptozoology, but we can't throw the baby out with the bathwater. We have the term. Let's define it so that it does have meaning for zoology. And the definition he arrives at is basically any unknown animal that is investigated or known through anecdotal evidence. That's something the simplification of the definition, but if you look up tetrapod zoology, you'll find Darren's very entertaining and very worthwhile articles, and I think you'll find, if you have any interest in zoology, especially as involves odd critters, which Mr. Nash is very interested in. Today's blog posting was on spiked tree frogs, biting spiked tree frogs.
Ow.
Well, they're tiny little fellows, but they're ruthless.
Yeah, but there's lots of them.
And interestingly, I learned, you tend to think of frogs as, you know, egg, tadpole, frog. There are evidently species of frogs that they carry their eggs about the back, and they don't go through a tadpole stage.
Yeah, that
they emerge as miniature adults.
I oh god.
Oh, I know the one you're thinking about, the one that's the little pockets all over the back, and
yeah,
it's like little frog launchers.
Oh,
yeah, god. That's
seeing that as a child, and just, oh, it still gives me shivers. It's just, ugh.
I'm sorry, man. I didn't mean to bring up an unpleasant memory for you.
No, I've never seen one in real life other than just the photographs, and that was enough, or even maybe some video, I guess.
Actually, not day before yesterday, the 15th, at Lauren Coleman's Cryptomundo, the post, should cryptozoology throw out, quote, hangers-on, unquote. And Lauren came across a another blogger, Lutra, of Lutra's Soapbox, in a blog entitled Fox with Mange, has this to say about our favorite subject. Cryptozoology is the study of hidden or unproven animals, ones not yet scientifically recognized. The plus side is that new species being discovered, or rather animals long known to native peoples as good to eat, that's in quotes, get classified by skeptical scientists. Unfortunately, too many self-styled cryptozoologists lack the scientific training and skepticism required for real scientific study. It's these people who prevent cryptozoology from being taken seriously by the scientific community and being dismissed as yeti hunting. The problem is, with no need for formal qualifications, anyone unable to identify a creature seems to call himself, herself, a cryptozoologist. How very egalitarian of Neutra to use the him-her. Well, anyway, and I read that in a deliberately snooty and scathing voice. And I took the trouble of going to the blog itself and reading the blog posting in its entirety. Lauren quotes extensively from it, but it is only excerpted. But honestly, there's...
That's not excreted?
Well, the blog is bulked out with a lot of pictures of big cats. Glad you think so. Yeah. Anyway, it's basically Miss Lutra is herself a person with some scientific credentials, although she apparently went into industry because it paid better. She's something of a geneticist, I gather. The quote as a whole is, but what really got me was that Lauren was actually the first post on her blog, and he basically said, I have responded here, and her response was initially a cool but polite, well, you're entitled to your opinion. And then she comes back with another, but if I were, if you'd scroll up a little bit, I'd rather quote this correctly. You are entitled to your opinion, but until Cryptozoology stops regarding every Tom, Dick, and Sally as a cryptozoologist in training, it is destined to remain a pseudoscience. That's at 122, and 14 minutes later, and what a pity you only allow your own WordPress hangers-on to comment on your blog. Now, I have no idea what a WordPress hanger-on is, but I've registered and posted there without any problems. I've never met, corresponded, or even spoken to Lauren Coleman. So, there is an awful lot of... I hate to use the catch-all term attitude in the post, because, I loathe the expression, but there's very definitely an attitude of condescension and derision.
But that's common when people start talking about, this or that upstart science not being a science or suffering from not being a science because of. I mean, that's just... You've got scientists who are scientists and want science to cover these things and get frustrated that, like she is, that anybody can go and practice this when it's not, it doesn't have any formal credentialing.
Well, it kind of dovetails with what I was saying a while back, and to expand on that, cryptozoology isn't a science. Zoology is a science. Cryptozoology is a term that describes an aspect of zoology. I don't object to the term. I don't even object to... her beef seems to be with people who get a bit enthusiastic, a bit excited.
She hates blob watchers.
pretty much, that's it in a nutshell. She cites specifically the... fair spate of what were described in many instances as foxes with mange, some form of dog or canid that was a bit of a flap roughly a year ago, kind of culminated with the story of the Maine mutant. And I have to admit, you've heard me go on the show in the past bemoaning what seems a lot of times like a bit too much, not exactly pandering, but a bit too much playing to the gallery in the posting. But at the same time, I read this woman's comments, and I find myself going, thank you, not for expressing those thoughts, but for making me reflect upon, basically the difference between genuine science, a genuine scientific spirit, which is what I see in blogs like Darren Nash's and Chad Arment's, who incidentally has a new article up at strangeark.com on basically Crypto, let's see. Ah, mythical animals from Greenland.
Did I go to the wrong place?
Yeah, they're in the Bio40 and Review. And mythical animals from Greenland. And it's interesting. Lutra's blog makes an interesting assertion that cryptozoology has been around since the 19th century, although it's only been under that name since the middle of the 20th. And that's essentially a correct observation. You have Ordeman's Great Sea Serpent appearing early in the 19th century. And much of what Miles has pulled up, the Mythical Animals of Greenland article, much of what Mr. Armit's latest article is based on are from a late 19th century report that essentially dismisses a lot of what sound to be folkloric or totemic creatures, some of which have aspects that, you know, could very well indicate that they were at one time genuine terrestrial creatures. Interestingly enough, the fellow quoted in the article is rather dismissive as of most of these Inuit superstitions, as I think he calls them. And it's, you know, it's not edgy or controversial, you know. Like I said, most of the sources are 19th century, but it's still indicative of the kind of work that, you know, I consider to be the meat, the heart and soul of true cryptozoology.
Now somebody's got to do the more mundane side of things.
Well,
it's,
you know,
it looks like it's mostly about seals and I guess other tusked critters, maybe
some seals, a possibly cryptid wolf or wolf-like animal.
But did it walk on two legs like a wolf man?
Ahoo, werewolves of Greenland. not too commonly seen. Warren Zevon, I hope he's listening wherever he is. And I hope it's cool and dry. Anyway.
You know, I noticed a bunch of other things. So Tim Banal getting some mention over at Cryptomundo, Bigfoot and the Dover Demon and Red Sox Nation. Tim Banal and Don Keating. Don has his Ohio State shirt on for the night, the first night of the conference, and then probably wore his Cleveland Indians outfit for the night of his presentation while in the midst of Red Sox Nation. Banal being a very big baseball fan. So Tim Banal, Banal of America, is one of the radio shows that we feature here on Anomaly Radio, and you should check out his stuff at banalofamerica.com and anomalyradio.com. You can listen to his shows weekly here on the station. And he's mentioned in another post Banal, Keating, and me, another Lauren Coleman, and there's a nice photo of them next to each other, and Banal giving the old Fonzie sign.
And Lauren Coleman holding up a Bigfoot.
Not his own. Man, so what else is going on? We got, oh, this is intriguing. From the writer-producer of the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre comes this vintage horror tale based on the recently acquired journals of Texan Dale S. Rogers. It's The Wild Man of the Navidad, based on the journals of Dale S. Rogers.
And the name gets tossed around like it ought to be familiar, but I have no idea who Dale S. Rogers is.
Yeah, I don't know.
Okay.
It could be completely fictional. I don't know.
I did watch the trailer with the sound off earlier today, and one of the respondents to this post called it Boggy Creek 2007, and I have to
say, I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing.
Well, it has a very Legend of Boggy Creek look to it. There are, you know, as far as I can tell, no name actors in it. It looks like it could be a good scary monster movie fun. As a number of the, I think a couple of the other respondents point out that this, you know, it's another, you know, murderous Bigfoot, and this is the sort of behavior that is extremely anecdotal in Bigfoot. He doesn't go around, tearing people in two. And, you know, there's aspects of it that make you think that it's actually some, you know, kind of deranged giant individual, because it does appear to be wearing clothes, and apparently it's using a pair of deer antlers as weapons.
Weird. The poster they have there for it, I kind of like, though it really, it's got such a weird amateurish look to it, with the drawing. It's a photograph of a lone house surrounded by scrub brush, and a nice photoshopped in sunset in the background and a full moon above in the same picture.
yes.
And the
whoops.
The wild man looks like this real, you know, scratchily drawn sketch of some green, yellow-eyed wild man wearing what looked like leaves. With some tusks coming out of its rather scary-looking teeth mouth, holding in each hand antlers.
Deer antlers.
That almost make it look like it has claws, but it's clear, if you look closely, you can see he's clearly holding them, which I actually kind of like that. You know, I guess they could have gotten a little more stylized and have them.
Well, you know, it's one of those, the thing that popped into my head was an organic Freddy Krueger.
Yeah.
You know, but it's a monster movie. It is a monster movie. It's not a documentary. It's like the most abused phrase in English at the moment, as far as I'm concerned, is based on true events.
Yeah.
You know, because it's kind of like, well, we use the names.
right. Everything else has been changed. But I think that's probably going to wrap it up for this week's edition of Precognitive Dissonance. So we'd like to thank you for tuning in, and hope you'll tell your friends about the show if you like it.
Heck, tell them about it if you don't, because, you know, there is no such thing as bad advertising. And, you know, if you have anything to say, for God's sake, for kids' sake, Cthulhu, log in or just click by precognitivedissonance.com and leave us a comment on the show.
Indeed. All right, thanks again. Have a great night, and we'll see you next time.
We're doing this because we love it, but, you know, we want to hear from our audience.
All right, take care. Good night.
It had a shape like nothing I've ever seen. The body of the thing looks to me like a circle. I can see it's patterns on the bottom of it. But it looked like some type of hieroglyphics.